Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
This is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul Channel. And it is Tuesday, September 9th, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I just want to remind people that they can call in at 914-338-0695. And we have a chat room going at healingwithdrdaniels.chatango.com, and you are invited to join the lively discussion. Okay, so tonight, the fight for the cure and why the cure never comes. I just have to say that when I entered medical school, I was so excited. And we were so imbued with the hope of future research, which, of course, was the only way we could endure the dismal results of the methods we were presently being taught in medical school. I mean, we just did not see anybody getting better. It was just overwhelmingly awful. But we had that hope that research was going to find the answer. So I was thoroughly convinced that all that was needed was more research, and that they would find the answer. When I say the answer, I mean something that would help people get better, that would help them experience relief from illness and from suffering. Now, during medical school, I was very struck by the fact that some research questions, were so easily answered and could be answered by a study of even 3 months' duration. Yet these studies that would have been so informative were never done. I mean, as a doctor, one thing that always kicked around in my brain was I have three drugs I could use for a particular affliction. Which one's better? Duh. Never see head-to-head trials comparing one to the other. I say, Sam the Kettle Man, what's up with that? Or you have a particular illness and you just want to know, what would happen if I did nothing? What would happen if I did nothing? And every single research study compares do what you're doing now or a new method, whatever it might be. And so I even asked the professors, I said, well, why don't we have any studies comparing doing nothing to the intervention that we're giving? Because it seems that the results are so dismal that it would be unethical to even continue what we are doing with such dismal results. So this was the answer they gave me. Oh, Dr. Daniels, the methods we are using have been scientifically proven. It would be unethical to withhold any of these therapies from patients. And I kind of scratched my head on that because we were using methods that had less than a 1%, 2% success rate. And I just couldn't imagine how doing nothing could be worse. At least if we did nothing, the person wouldn't suffer all these needles. And at least if we did nothing, the person's bill would be lower, of course. Silly of me, yes. In my defense, I was only between the age of 22 and 26, right? Didn't know that. I didn't realize that the bill was the objective, making the bill as large as possible. And so I just said, man, it doesn't seem like you're looking in the right places for this improvement. And it's this research. I don't know who's directing it. It's just not really getting there. And so tonight what I'm going to share with you is my experiences as a member. I was a member of the board of the American Heart Association of Central New York. Now, I didn't make it to national. I saw enough at the city level, thank you. And my experience with the United Way, being on the board of the United Way, and my experience with friends who worked for the March of Dimes. And so I think, and then, of course, we have to talk about Michael Milken, my favorite person. I really admire Mike Milken. He's been through a lot, and I think he's really done very well. And so I think he can show us the way. So we're going to talk about that. Now, while I was in medical school, in the early 80s, Mike Milken, or we'll say the late 70s, Mike Milken was on Wall Street. He was what's called a junk bond king. I'll explain more about that later, but the big thing to understand is he raised a lot of money on Wall Street and made a lot of money. And so, unfortunately, you know, sometimes bad luck crosses your path. He was prosecuted, investigated, and eventually confessed to some type of irregularity pertaining to trading. And he ended up in jail. And so, of course, at the tender age of between 22 and 26, I heard about this with some vague information. I said, oh, isn't that terrible? Well, I hope he gets out soon. Didn't think much more of it. And then the reports came out that Mr. Milken had prostate cancer. You know, it's an awful prostate cancer. And it was going to kill him. In 18 months, he would be dead. And I said, oh, my God. It's absolutely awful. I didn't hear much more about that. That's the amount of the story I experienced as a medical student / young doctor. And the story kind of just sat there for a minute. Until I started in medical practice in the 90s. And in the early 90s, I was a vegetarian, on my way to being vegan, and I pick up my vegetarian magazine, and on the cover of the magazine is Michael Milken himself juicing vegetables and talking about how the vegan diet cured his prostate cancer. Well, that was all I needed to know. Here we have a man made lots and lots of money, went to jail, had terminal disease, beat the disease, and now he's eating vegetables. This was it. Man, I copied that cover, and I showed it to every single man in my medical practice who refused to eat his veggies. And I told him, if Milken can eat veggies, you can too. And they went for it. So it didn't end there. So if you read Milken's, he really goes into great detail about his medical journey, which is really the pertinent thing for tonight, although it does double back and dovetail with his financial journey. And so Milken got out of jail because, of course, he didn't have much time to live either. So he contacts the Search for the Cure Prostate Cancer Research Foundation, and he actually does his research. And he finds the organization doing prostate cancer research that's the closest to the cure. And he contacts him and says, hey, I'm Michael Milken. I've got prostate cancer, and I'm dying, and I need you guys to find a cure. How close are you? So, well, he thinks they come, and we think we're pretty close. He said, well, or the $1 million close, or $5 million, well, how close are you? He said, well, we could certainly use every bit of that. He said, look, take $12 million. $12 million to find the cure saved my life. And so he gives them this money, $12 million. He checks back with them in 6 months. He says, well, this is Michael Milken calling back. I gave you $12 million. I want the cure. He says, excuse me, Mr. Milken? He says, well, I gave you $12 million. I want the cure. I want the cure of cancer. I said, well, we don't work that way. We don't have the cure yet. We're just doing research. And so then, time running out, right, 6 months into his 18-month life he's got to live. So then he goes back, and he says to them, hey, it's been another 3 months. Where's the cure? We don't have the cure. We're just going to keep looking. He says, what about my $12 million? And they say, I'm paraphrasing, none of your business. And he says, oh, I don't get a refund? They said, no, you don't. I don't get a cure? They said, no, you don't. So Milken did what every good American would do. He got on a plane and flew to China. And in China, they told him, what some actor told him, go vegan. No meat, no dairy, your prostate cancer will go away. But they were much more elegant than me because it was Milken you're dealing with. You can't just tell a man this rich and this important to stop eating meat and dairy and eating vegetables. No. You got to give him some Chinese herbs and a little talking and some meditation and just smooch it up, which he did. And so he flies back to the United States with his herbs in tow. And by now he's got a juicer, and he's juicing for life. And, of course, the end of the story, of course, you know, because now it's 20, 30 years later, and he's doing very nicely, going strong. And so he cured himself. Now, there are people who would have been very angry and upset about this, and they even have tried to press charges against the cancer people, but not Milken. And not Milken. Milken said, what really happened here? And so what really happened was this research organization sold me a junk bond. They sold me a junk bond. And when I went to collect, they said, sorry, Charlie. And what happened was what they did was totally legal. And wow, maybe I can legally apply junk bond technology to research. Before we go to get ahead of myself, I need to make sure everybody knows what a junk bond is. Okay, what are junk bonds? This comes from Bonds200, Morningstar.com. And this is a course on bonds. So what are junk bonds? When you buy a bond, you are lending your money to someone who promises to pay you in the future at a specified date plus interest. Now, to understand this in terms of research, when you pay money to a research consortium, you are giving them money to promise you an outcome, research, or the cure at a specified point in time. So, Milken thought. Now, the ability of the bond issuer to meet its obligation, keep its word, is expressed as a bond's credit rating. Because junk bonds have a high default risk, they are speculative. Let me put this in English for you. A bond is called a junk bond, and the chance of you ever getting what was promised is very small, like close to zero. So, and they go into a bunch of detail. And so what he realized then was that the research company had essentially, in a verbal, of course, issued to him a junk bond. they held themselves out to be able or capable of finding a cure. They accepted his money, and he told them he had 18 months, and they did not find a cure and really had no chance. No, they were not looking for a cure. And so what Milliken realized was that here was an area, research, where wholesale issuance of junk bonds was okay. In other words, you can fundraise in this arena basically selling people junk bonds. In other words, an empty promise. And it was perfectly legal. In fact, it was even tax deductible. So the return was built in when you got the deduction. It was really cool. So this is what Milken discovered. So Milken discovered that junk bond methods and technology could be applied to research. And for that, I'm sure research can thank him for advancing certainly their amount of available funds. So that was Milken's journey. Nowadays, he is really an exuberant fundraiser, raising incredible amounts of money using the same junk bond concept, only applying it to cancer research and other areas where the return can be expected to be just about zero. In other words, legal junk bonds. So having encountered Mr. Milliken in his journey, I said, that's interesting. But I hadn't really understood the true depth of it until we had, many of you know, in cancer fundraisers, a popular fundraising is run for the cure. And so when you run for the cure, the runners will raise money. People will sponsor them so much, pennies or dollars per mile, or people will donate a certain lump sum to enter the race, or usually they keep the entry cost pretty low because they want a lot of runners, you know, good press opportunity. Okay. And so I ended up one time on the back end of this. When I say the back end, I mean I was involved with actually planning a fundraiser run for the cure type event. And there was a problem with this event. The problem was this. If you have a longer event, let's say a 10K event, then theoretically you have more miles to be run, let's say 10 miles and sponsorship per mile so much, and you can potentially raise more money. On a shorter race, like say a 5K race, you know, it's only 5 kilometers to raise money on. So how do you do this? And so you would think intellectually, probably the audience would think, well, shucks, have a 15K race. Uh-uh. It turns out that people who can run 15K are lousy fundraisers. They don't get a whole lot of sponsors. They just pay the minimum, join the race, and they run and they run and they run. And there's no revenue for the people who are raising money. And so that's why all these K runs are under 10K. That's a big reason why. Because the big money people who raise a lot of money just don't run that far. And so then what got me when I was behind my desk as a doctor and taking care of patients was, how can my running 1K, 2Ks, or 5Ks prevent someone I've never met from getting cancer? How can my running and giving money help someone who's already got cancer get better? I couldn't figure it out. And I have a lot of experience figuring out a lot of pretty tenuous associations. So what happened was, I decided I wouldn't have anything to do with any races because I couldn't figure out how me running was going to create a cure. And then I got further into it by being on the board of the American Heart Association. Now, being on the American Heart Association Board of Directors was truly an experience. So I show up to the American Heart Association board meeting, and I'm here, and I'm excited because we're going to find a cure. Here we are, we're on the board. We're going to make some important administrative decisions that are going to bring the cure, I mean, right to our front door and to our patients. I was seriously excited. I show up for one meeting. There's a series of meetings here. So I show up for a board meeting. I'm sitting across from this guy. And we're talking about how it's so important for us to find a cure for heart disease. And we need to really implement this cure for heart disease. Now, I had started deviating from the straight and narrow path, and I had at this point already started recommending fruits and vegetables. Well, more vegetables than fruit, actually. I never recommend fruit. I only recommend vegetables. So I'm recommending vegetables and no meat and all kinds of stuff. And so this guy yawned at me, as you can say, yawned in my face. He says, "Oh, doctor, everybody knows that if you want to get rid of your heart disease, you just have to eat stuff that looks just like it looked when it came out of the ground. And eat more vegetables and less meat and get some exercise and heart disease just go right away. We're not looking for a cure here. We're just raising money." Well, surely that was only the voice of one person on the board. Then I felt sure he couldn't be speaking for the whole board. Then there was another meeting. And this was the meeting. This was the meeting I was waiting for. Because we'd done a lot of fundraisers, and we were raising a fair amount of money. And our chapter of the American Heart Association was a very, well, successful chapter. And so we were going to see, we were going to get a personal report from a researcher that we had funded. And I said, wow, concrete action with funding research with the money we have raised. And the researcher came in. He's a young guy, certainly under 40. Actually, he was young even then, which means I was 40, which made him in his 30s. And he started presenting his research. First of all, curious was that he was an employee of the local teaching hospital, number one. Number two, his research was highly theoretical. It didn't even have anything to do with patients. It related to cells. And so, of course, I had to scratch my head, raise my hand, and say, well, how long will it take us to clinically apply your research findings? And so he said, well, I don't know that they'll ever be applied. So I was speechless. I'm raising money. I'm going to board meetings, spending time away from my family to fund something that's not even going to help my patients. I was speechless. It was when I saw that researcher that I realized what the problem was with the search for the cure, what the problem was with research, and why the cure could never be found. Here's a researcher we're funding, employed by a university that only makes money when a person actually has heart disease and gets sick and requires surgical intervention. So this person, just by nature of his employment, has a serious conflict of interest. And when funds are raised and then plowed right back into employees of, representatives of, or institutions themselves that only profit by sickness, then these research funds are necessarily compromised and unlikely to find a cure, something that's going to diminish the revenue of that company. Now, many people will take a look at this and say, well, doctor, what about the people who are employed at universities and they're researching and looking for cures at universities? That's a good question. Many universities receive substantial funds from pharmaceutical industry, from pharmaceutical companies. And so if they have a researcher doing research, they're not going to take too kindly to him doing research. It's going to jeopardize substantial funding that they have. So then you have a conflict built in at a much higher level. So you have a university that gets substantial funding from pharmaceutical interests on many levels. And then you have fundraisers raising money for the cure and giving this money to those universities to find the cure. And this is how our research is being directed, how our research funding is being directed. So running for the cure, whether you're organizing the run, whether you're putting on the T-shirt and actually doing the running, is futile because the funds, even if 100% of them were spent on research for the cure, they're being given to representatives of the pharmaceutical industry and of the hospital industry and device manufacturing industry. And these are areas that have a conflict of interest. And what has happened over the years, as we look at charitable organizations, our attention is diverted. We are trained to look at, well, what percent of this organization's money is going for administrative overhead? How much is really going to search for the cure? Instead, we should look at the part that is going to search for the cure. Well, where is it going? Well, where are they looking? Well, who are they paying to do the looking? And then we can see then that this money has almost zero chance, not almost, excuse me, absolutely zero chance of finding something that's going to reduce the amount of time, money, and suffering a person spends on disease. And this is the true travesty of the search for the cure. So I was disappointed at the American Heart Association. I was disillusioned. Needless to say, I was on the board for only a year. They didn't ask me back, and I didn't ask to come back. So then we had the United Way. Many of you might be familiar with the United Way. Kind of like the UN of charitable giving. So the United Way funds many organizations that look for cures. And so the United Way has this assortment of charitable organizations, and it gives money to them. So I was invited one year to be on the board of the United Way. I said, aha, I'm getting closer. This is it. This is my chance to make a contribution. This is my chance to get involved and to increase the effectiveness of these programs so it can be of more help to my patients and get them healthier.
Yeah.
So I was going to my United Way meetings, and I thought that I was making a contribution. So one day, the president of the United Way came to my office. And really sharp guy, very nice person. And I think he eventually became one of my patients. He sits down in a chair and says to me, "Dr. Daniels, I understand that you're a doctor and that, you know, as your earnings increase, of course your expenses increase. That's the natural way of things. We always live a little bit beyond our means. It's the way with individuals and with organizations as well." I'm like, what? Live beyond my means? I wouldn't think of it. I was just absolutely horrified that anyone would think living beyond their means was okay, that anyone would think living on credit was okay. As I said, I was young. And so he painted this picture that in my mind was a picture of total irresponsibility. And it culminated in a request that I make a donation to the United Way to help them with their profligate ways. And surely being a profligate myself, I would understand. Of course, he made a lot of assumptions there. I said, oh my God, I said, well, sir, I think I can help the United Way even more than I imagine. Maybe I can help you guys do within your means. Well, I think that's the biggest sin of all, is spending more money than you got. He could see that his plea for funds had just been misdirected. So what I did, though, I figured I'd try something. I would give the United Way $1,000. So I did that. Reached in my pocket. And I gave $1,000. I think I wrote a check, as a matter of fact. I wrote a check for $1,000. I said, here's a check for $1,000. See what you can do with that. He says, oh, my God, Dr. Daniels. Thank you so much. I thought, you're welcome. No problem. So I come to the next meeting. And of course, I'm expecting to hear all the great things that happened with this $1,000. Did they hire an efficiency expert? Did they install some energy efficiency in the office? Did they, I don't know, anything. Who knows? What did they do with this $1,000 that would help the United Way get within their means so they could be more effective with the donations they receive? Excuse me, I was shocked. Nothing. Not a thing. The only thing on the table was a raise for the executive who had come to visit me because he had been so effective at raising money that surely he should get a percent of it. So I scratched my head. I said, something's not working here. Something's not working here. And then at that point, I just decided that it really was not adding up, wasn't going well at all. And then I look back to my time at Wharton University of Pennsylvania. My classmate back then. My classmate had a habit. And in order to take care of his habit, he had to place his order on Fridays and go pick up his fix, let's say, on Saturday. And this was a pretty regular thing. And so I asked him, I said, well, what's going on here? You know, this doesn't seem very responsible to me. And so I said, well, you know, Jennifer, things are just not always what you think they are. I said, well, okay, I'll go along with that. And so it wasn't 4 years later, he became the president of the National March of Dimes. I said, holy schmoly. Well, can't be too much responsibility going on in that organization, could there be? Oh, my God. And he stayed in the job for quite some time. So what's really going on then is it's magical thinking to believe that giving money to a disinterested third party can help a needy second party. So, for example, let's say you're a listener and you want to move closer to the cure for a particular ailment. Let's just say the ailment is, how about prostate cancer? That's a good one, prostate cancer. And as you know, in the United States, they are still struggling with the cure for prostate cancer. That's not one published that I'm aware of. And even though, Mr. Milken, and he's not the only one, many people, have cured themselves of prostate cancer with a vegan diet and a few strategically taken herbs, we don't see any efforts to amplify this message or transmit this information. And even Milken himself, you don't see that happening. And the answer why is because it's not profitable. And so if you give money to an entity that is not designed to cure, and then you expect a cure to happen, well, it's just unrealistic thinking, as they used to say in our psychiatry course in medical school. And so there will be no cure, because the organizations we give our money to are dedicated to raising more money. And once the cure appears, then the irrelevance disappears. Now, the other thing that happens is, as I mentioned before, these organizations, hospitals, universities, all have a conflict of interest in that they are substantially funded by disease-creating entities such as hospitals, manufacturing device makers, and drug companies. And what this does is it creates a situation where you're asking an organization to accept what amounts to maybe 1% of their revenue in exchange for curtailing 70% of their revenue. Well, that's just not going to happen. That's not a reasonable thing. So the other reason why so the search for the cure will never be found. The cure will never be found because those searching have an interest in not finding it. And the other question is, well, why is it that those are searching have an interest in not finding it? And the answer is, even if, let's say, a local church or not even a church, let's just say a private citizen, John Q. Public, goes to work every day. He makes whatever he makes, a little bit of money, maybe a lot of money, doesn't matter the amount. He decides he wants to give $10,000. $10,000 is a good amount of money, to an organization to search for the cure. If he takes that $10,000 and gives it to one of the usual suspects, that would be a university or a hospital or, heaven forbid, a public clinic, and he gets a tax deduction, which you might look at that as a $2,000 to $4,000 kickback, depending on his income or tax bracket. But if he takes that $10,000 and says, forget that, I'm going to go down the street, this guy, I know he's got cancer, and I'm going to give him a gift of $10,000 worth of organic vegetables and replace his juicer if it breaks. And I'm going to do all these things, dum, 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 to help that person. He gets no tax deduction, none whatever. Very interesting. And it's also against the law for these donations to go or to inure to the benefit of any one individual. So you can't raise money and then use it to provide for the care of any one individual. Then it violates tax-exempt philosophies. And if you take that money and give it directly to somebody that you perceive to be sick, so that they can, in their own wisdom, cure themselves in their own way, then the government has all kinds of objections to that. And so this is why searching for the cure in an organizational way, the cure will never come. It will never, ever show up. There's too many laws restricting entities that can be funded for the cure, and laws restricting how money can be deployed to heal any one particular person. And so I thought that that was really just really shocking. And what this led me to do, it led me to really lose my confidence in research, the practice of research as it's now appreciated in the United States. Because then the topic of the research is constrained. How success is defined is constrained. The methods and tools used are all constrained and under the control of the entities that are creating the disease in the first place. And with this type of structure in place, it's not possible to find a cure or to effect a cure with money. So money is not the way to the cure. Now, if money were the way to the cure, just by the way, how should it be spent? So let's talk. I think that would be useful to take a look at. If money could buy cures, what would be the way to, one, create the cure, and two, distribute the cure? So the first thing is, how can you find a cure? The answer is, the only way a cure is going to be found is somebody outside of these systems has to find a cure. This is an article on the internet where a 12-year-old boy found a cure, and an early detection test for pancreatic cancer, something PhDs couldn't do in decades. Why? Because he had nobody restricting his ability to search. He had nobody telling him, look here, not there. He had nobody telling him, no dessert for you if you find something that might reduce suffering or expense on medical care. So the important thing then is the funding, if someone were so inclined to create funding, would need to go to individuals who are curious, who have an interest, preferably individual who has as little education as possible. I know it's shocking coming from someone like me who has a medical degree and an MBA and a bachelor's degree. I will say in my defense that I did wake up one day and realize I had enough and I was getting no more. So it's important then to, if you're going to spend money on financing research, to finance inexpensive research, there are a lot of guerrilla research going on the internet, which I find very impressive. I'm most impressed with ones that are actually allowing people, hey, are you taking this drug? Great. What effects are you experiencing? And people are actually saying, hey, I'm getting this, that, and other effect. And now what they're getting is the people's PDR, which is a symptom based on what people are reporting. And so this is the kind of search that needs to go on. It's search that needed, not research. So not a rehashing of old information, but finding of new information based on citizens and what they're actually experiencing. So first thing is you have to finance different sources. Second, different kinds of research. The kind of research based, I think, initially at least on observation. What are people experiencing? One thing that's never, ever documented, which I think should be documented, is what happens to people who refuse care. What happens to people who refuse care? And that's a story that needs to be told. And that's a story that researchers are instructed to ignore. So these are very, very low-cost research. And that's what's got to happen. The lack of a cure, a lack of information, has nothing to do, whatever, with money. Because the money being spent on research presently is astronomical. But what it's not being spent on is finding out what's going on with people who refuse care, finding out what's going on with people who do take care and certain types of care that they submit to. What's really going on? And so that is the type of research that's needed just as a baseline. The next thing to look at, of course, is there's two things that are assiduously ignored. One is the role of environment, the role of chemicals in the environment, and two, the role of the individual's behavior. One reason, for example, why wealthier and more educated people actually do experience more disease is because they tend to consume more chemicals. And many people don't even realize they're consuming chemicals. I was talking to a person the other day, he only shops at, Whole Foods markets and who researches everything she eats, and she can tell you the company that manufactures each and every food she eats. Well, if a, you've already kind of lost the game there. And so what needs to be researched is people whose foods come from corporations, how are they doing? How is their health? What kind of afflictions do they have? And people who do not eat food from corporations, how's their health? This is what needs to be not researched, but searched. Information needs to be searched out. These are comparisons that need to be made and that are not being made. So that's if you want to spend money. What if you don't want to spend money? Right? Either you're on a budget or you're sick and tired of research. Personally, I reach such a point of annoyance being bombarded with all these research results from drug reps where the research didn't even ask a clinically useful question. I just threw up my hands. I said, you know what? I'm done with research. I'm looking for information, and I'll draw my own conclusions. But if you're through with that, then I challenge you, in terms of curing anything, to first look to yourself. Personal responsibility. Because I think that you're all powerful. Oh, well, maybe you might be, but it's because you don't have control over anyone else except yourself anyway. So might as well start there. And that's important. It's very important because as much as you might want other people to do things differently, as much as it would be like really cool if there were no chemtrails, it'd be like really great if all food in the store was organic. The truth of the matter is that may not be especially relevant. So what kind of personal responsibility? What am I talking about? What I'm talking about is a look at what you could possibly be doing to contribute to any illness you may be experiencing. That's what I'm talking about. And usually, the illness you're experiencing, you didn't get it cheap. They don't come free. These chemicals are expensive. So the chemicals that are poisoning you, I am certain, can be found in your shopping cart. They're right there in the shopping cart. Whatever store you shop at. If you're not feeling perfectly fine, the poisons are in the shopping cart. The next place they might be is look at your charge card bill. What did you buy lately? Did you go to the department store? Maybe you bought some polyurethane pillows. Or maybe you went to the department store in the cosmetics counter and you got some cosmetics. maybe bought some new clothes and they're out gassing from aldehyde from China. So there's all kinds of possibilities. And so I think if you look in your shopping cart and then look at your charge card, you know, what did you charge, or did you order something in the mail or something like that, that's where you're going to find the cause. And once you relieve the cause, that creates something called a cure. Why is that? That's because your body is constantly repairing and fixing itself. So if you stop damaging it with chemicals, then it will catch up and start fixing itself eventually at a faster rate than it's being damaged. And so that's a true way to find the cure. So we've got 10 more minutes left of the show. And if people have questions, they can just click on the thing there, and we'll take questions. And we've got quite a bit of chatter going on in the chat room. Okay. So the person says, are you saying that the body is like a fine machine that needs the right fuel? Answer is yes. However, the body that needs the correct fuel, the fuel that's correct is quite diverse. In other words, it's available wherever you live on this earth. And it's manufactured by plants and by nature, so it's not manufactured by humans. That's one clue to identifying it. Okay, so next question. How can people refuse care? Okay, there's two ways to refuse care. The first way to refuse care is to not show up. And then the step before that in refusing care is to not have insurance. This is really important. So don't have insurance. And if you're really cool, like a lot of kids have tattoos, you know, you get a tattoo. And the tattoo says, no consent, no payment. Or do not, you can say, do not treat without my consent. Or wake me up and ask. So whatever kind of creative tattoo that does not make it okay to scrape you off the ground and take you to a hospital, very important that that not happen. So the first step, so one level of refusal is to not get insured. Next level of refusal is if you are insured, or if you're not insured, don't show up. The next level of refusal is if you do show up, to say, I'm praying on it. All right? If you say no, it's what we're taught in medical school. If anyone refuses care, they've got to be crazy, because all this stuff we're doing is so beneficial. So for someone to not think it's beneficial, they could only be crazy. And so then any refusal is instead seen as a sign of mental weakness or mental incompetence, not seen as the valid decision of a competent adult. So that's why once you show up, it's difficult to refuse. But you still can refuse because of your right to practice your religion. Which religion you're practicing is nobody's business, by the way. You can just say, I am praying on it. You need to say what God you're praying to. If they try and ask you what God you're praying to, tell them it's personal. We learn that as kids. Mom said, now, you don't have to answer every question people ask you. You don't want to answer a question. Just tell them it's personal. Okay, so you're grown up, you can still use that child's excuse, it's personal. So when you're confronted with a doctor who's coming at you with a knife or a needle or whatever, you can say, no, thank you. Don't, I'm praying on it. And so, well, what God are you praying to? The answer is, that's personal. That's very important to refuse. Now the next thing, the next step in refusal, which is what I'm hoping somebody will pick up the ball and run with, or maybe I can even do it, is if you refuse care, I think it's important to form some kind of association on the internet. People who refuse care will report what happened when they refuse care. In other words, report what happens when you refuse pneumonia treatment, for example. Yeah, doctor said I had pneumonia, offered me triple antibiotics. I said no, and yeah, I just feel great. Worked out fine. So it's really important, I think, for people to realize that there are people who refuse and what happens when they refuse. Another type of refusal, this is my favorite, and people say, oh, my God, I just didn't have enough money. I just couldn't afford to go to the doctor. If more people who don't go to the doctor because they can't afford it just say, I'm going to go to XYZ site, I'm going to say, I didn't have the money to go see the doctor. This was my problem. I didn't go, and this is what happened. And in 99% of those cases, people do absolutely just fine. And this is not publicized. What is publicized is the 1%, I think it's even less than 1%, who actually have an adverse outcome for lack of medical care. And it is such a rare event. It is a very rare event. In fact, when I was in medical practice, I actually had like a two-hour slot between patients. And so I was sitting there with this empty slot on my schedule. And I was thinking, I was looking over the past week's worth of patients, how many of those patients, if they had not shown up, would have done just fine? And I was really shocked. I'm ashamed to say that it was a pretty large number. It was about, I would say, out of a full schedule of maybe 100 patients or so a week, I would say about three, if they hadn't shown up, would have had a worse outcome. And this is actually the truth of the matter. Now, another thing that happens, I looked over my schedule, and how many of these people came here of their own free will. Now, what does their own free will mean? That means they decided that they wanted to come see the doctor. It wasn't an employee physical. It wasn't a school physical. It wasn't a back-to-work sick note or some reason mandated by a third party for them to get either a benefit or something certified. And I was surprised that fully 10% of my practice was what I call non-voluntary visits. And so the way to find a cure is to stay home more often. That was number one, stay home more often. Now also you can go to my website, sign up to my list, and you will get a list of 10 cures, remedies so powerful that they made antibiotics in my medical practice obsolete. So that's the end of today's radio show, and we will see you back again next week. Topic to be determined. So sign up on the list, you'll get the radio show notices, and you'll also get a 10 cures so powerful they make antibiotics obsolete.